Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Our next guest is Rod Pyle. He's written a book, a great book, called Interplanetary Robots: The True Stories of Space Exploration. Award-winning science writer Rod Pyle profiles both the remarkable spacecraft and the amazing scientists and engineers who made them possible. From the earliest sprints past Venus and Mars to Voyager 1's current explorations of the space between the stars, this new book sheds light on ever more ambitious journeys designed to increase the human reach into the solar system. Rod Pyle, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, and thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Your book is so readable and so accessible, and you can tell that you've had a good time writing it.
Oh, good, because I did. I mean, writing any space book is kind of like being invited to sort of get down and roll around in your favorite subject and spend time doing it for pay, which is wonderful. But when I get a chance to write about that part of space history, because I was growing up then through a lot of that, and especially, I don't know what it is about the robotic stuff, but there's just something magical about the idea of machines millions or billions of miles out there doing the things that they're doing. It's kind of courageous. I'm anthropomorphizing them, obviously, but there's something very courageous about that.
Right. Well, if you look at from 1957, when the Soviet Sputnik, that was kind of the beginning, to right now, it's just over 60 years. If you look at time, that's a tiny amount of time, and we've come this far. When you look into the future, what do you see the next 60 years is holding?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that, because for the last couple of years, I've written a book for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is NASA's field center out in the west coast of the U.S., and part of that effort, it's like 30 of their coolest technology and engineering stories, which is, don't tell them, but they wouldn't have to pay me to do it. I'd do it for free because it's just so much
fun.
Keep
that a secret.
But a big part of that is talking to these really incredible, bright mission scientists and investigators, ranging from their late 20s. And how intimidating is it for a guy in his early 60s to talk to some kid who's 22 with their PhD about this amazing stuff they do? But so much of the future is about AI, the use of artificial intelligence deep in space, about lowering mass requirements, about lowering power requirements. What we're finding is that as access to launch into the deep solar system becomes much, much cheaper, I mean, we're talking about looking at something like the Falcon Heavy, a tenth of what the big old rockets used to cost, and needing less energy and needing less electronics and shielding mass to do what we want to do, you can start sending things the size of CubeSats, which is about the size of a Kleenex box or smaller, now not just in Earth orbit, but way out deeper in the solar system, and doing increasingly advanced and complicated work. So that's one aspect of it. Like the other aspect of it, and that becomes very generic, by the way, because a lot of that stuff is off the shelf, and similar components could do many different things throughout the solar system. On the other side, I think on the robotic exploration story, we see a lot more specialized, highly specialized machines, probably still fairly expensive, that can do things that we can't even imagine now, like going out into the outer solar system and actually landing and prospecting on some of these watery ocean moons that we're beginning to find that we think have, I'm sure you've talked about this, have warmer seas below the icy caps, the icy crust. Mm-hmm. And begin to really investigate what's happening out there and do so autonomously, because they don't need to talk to Earth anymore. They check in every week or six and let us know what's going on and go about their business. So I think those two things are big. And finally, I would say on the human spaceflight side, we're seeing this advancing sweet spot between human exploration, robotic exploration, where they not only go the scary, dangerous, dark places before we do, but they start building there. They build infrastructure, they explore, they prospect, and they make it possible for people to follow in their footsteps.
NASA has facilities all over the world, and they're chock full of really bright engineers and scientists. But there's something going on in Pasadena. You know, when you think about 10 Mariner missions starting in 1962, the entire Voyager series, the Juno mission to Jupiter, Kepler Space Telescope finding exoplanets, HAL Adam Stelzner landed the Curiosity, was able to break that thing enough so that they could land it carefully on the surface of Mars. Linda Spilker, Cassini, how about New Horizons to Pluto and then on to Ultima Thule? What is in the water in Pasadena?
Well, interesting you should say that, because actually, since the late 30s, early 40s, JPL was putting some stuff in the water that made it down to the rest of the city that they had to stop doing and clean up. There were perchlorates leaching into our water table, and we didn't want to grow any extra tentacles, which might have been kind of appropriate, though.
But JPL Caltech is
special, right?
Yeah, but JPL Caltech is the UNCOLA of NASA. I mean, they're different.
That is a great, oh man, I wish I'd heard that before I wrote the book. That's perfect. It is different. And if you go to many NASA field centers, I'm sure you've been to some of them, there's a sameness there. It's federal, it's government. A lot of them were built around the same time, the birth of the space race. And they're wonderful places, but they are staffed by civil servants. And that's a certain kind of work environment. Jet Propulsion Laboratory is paid for by NASA, but managed by Caltech. So in this weird arrangement that only JPL has, money goes from federal treasury to NASA to Caltech and then to JPL. And because of that, not only in terms of the way the place looks, but in terms of the way the place feels, it is very much like an extension of the campus in a couple of ways. It's pretty. It's nestled up in the foothills behind Pasadena. It can get kind of torchy hot in the summer, but the rest of the year it's really gorgeous up there. There's lots of trees. There's lots of places to stop and think and talk to your colleagues and so forth. And then, of course, also because of the Caltech connection, there's a lot of really brilliant people standing around, and you can just kind of see the heat waves radiating off of their scalps. You know, they're that smart. And, I love interviewing these people, but I have to remind them sometimes, you know, this isn't when you're, I'm not one of your grad school students, okay? You have to kind of talk. Look at my eyes. Talk down here. Because once they get going, and they could be, like I said, late 20s, early 30s, it's really something to keep up with. But just watching them work is really quite a pleasure.
Yeah. And Rod, I think you and I are similar in that we've always been space junkies, or I don't know what you'd call us, but when I was a kid, I mean, I studied everything that was Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and the test program before that. And I remember my mother and father bringing me out on the front lawn of the house to see Sputnik go by, because it was in a low orbit. It was moving very quickly. And that really instilled a lot of fear into people's minds about Russia being able to do that. And I thought I knew a lot about all this stuff, but I tell you, I did not know that U.S. and Russia wanted to detonate nukes on the moon back in 1958. I mean, that's probably one of the dumbest things our two countries have ever come up with, but let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, so there were these two projects that were kind of moving parallel to each other, to detonate nuclear warheads on the moon. Russia had one. They were actually going to send a hydrogen bomb up because they had nice, big, powerful rockets. And they were going to do so during a lunar eclipse and make a big flash. And, you know, there was this pretense of there'll be a little science laid on top of this. But really, it's just, you know, flashing the hammer and sickle on the side of the moon and saying, hey, capitalists, look what we can do. You know, you better hide under those formica desks that you've been crawling under to try and save yourself from our nuclear attack. And for those who are too young to remember, those were called drop drills, where they made school kids get under their desks because that was going to save us from thermonuclear fireballs back in the 60s. On the American side, we were going to use a smaller warhead, about a 1 to 2 kiloton yield, so much smaller even than Hiroshima. But we were going to launch it to circle the moon and then explode on the Terminator, and hopefully a large cloud of dust would come up and be backlit or sidelit and show what we had done. The advantage of that also, of course, is that we'd be able to do some science when we saw that dust in the air in terms of soil mechanics and composition and so forth. And that was what Carl Sagan was working on when he was part of this project, which had a long, complex name, like a study of the dynamics of soil on the lunar surface or something like that. But really, it was just a power play. And both countries were pursuing this with a fair amount of energy until, I think, about the same time both countries realized, you know, if we foul up our trajectories, that thing's going to sling around the backside of the moon, come right back to Earth, and we don't know where it's going to go. And that could be a very unfortunate day. So that project died a well-deserved death. But it was, when you read about it now, besides the chuckle factor, I don't know about you, but there's a little part of me, having grown up during the, you know, the great battle between the West and the Reds, that kind of goes, yeah, that might have been kind of cool, actually, if they'd pulled that off.
So unlike you and John, I'm a bit of a late adapter to space exploration. And therefore, as an adult, I can get so excited about things. And I have to say, I've watched the redirection of the Falcon Heavy back to its launch pad.
Oh, yes.
So many times. And each time I do, I'm just filled with emotion. And I'm always showing someone new who hasn't yet seen it or, you know, watched the video. And, you know, talking about the creativity and the brilliance at JPL, you know, talk about SpaceX a little bit. And there's that much more freedom, I guess, for creativity with SpaceX.
I will talk about SpaceX with pleasure. I was just over the other day dropping off a stack of books that I had promised them and got my VIP parking spot and got into the lobby and met with Elon's assistant and handed her a bunch of books. She said, okay, thanks. And there I was out the door. But a couple of years prior to that, I was actually given a tour of the place. And if you ever have a chance, it's not to be missed, because if you go to NASA facilities, they're building spacecraft, you'll see one or two things in each bay. It's a clean room. People are in bunny suits. Everything's very exacting and beautiful, very Germanic, if you will, given the origins of our space program. And it's impressive as heck to see. But then you go to SpaceX, it's impressive on a whole different level, which is it's just enough to do everything just right. So most of it's not a clean room environment. In fact, very little of it is. It's tens of thousands of square feet of factory space. But as far as the eye can see in any direction, to your left is second stage rocket interstages. To the right is the clean room where they're making engines. Straight ahead is the machining area where they're making all these components. And it's really like the General Motors of rockets. It almost looks like a cartoon from when I was growing up of what they thought space flight was going to look like. And at one point I was walking down a corridor and I saw a woman standing up on a ladder next to an interstage tank, grinding away with a metal grinder. And I looked at the engineer next to me and I said, is that how you do mass reduction here? And she smiled and said, yeah. Now, normally if this was a NASA rocket or something built by one of the traditional contractors during the missile days, you'd carve little triangles out of the metal in the fuselage to lighten it up. It's very effective and very, very, it uses up a lot of time and a lot of manpower. SpaceX, they just grind it with a grinder until it's thinner and then paint it. And I said, that's very Soviet of you. And they smiled again and said, yes. So it's very efficient. They just get the job done. And as you saw last year with the Falcon Heavy, I mean, I don't know how many space shuttle launches or Delta launches you went to on either coast in the past, but they rarely take place on time, often not even the same day. Falcon Heavy went up, went off at the minute it was supposed to, the day it was supposed to, the week it was supposed to, and did what it was supposed to. So besides just the total numbers of what Musk has done, which is basically take over half the world's launch market, he's done so in a really effective and efficient way, and he publishes his costs on the internet. I can go tell you right now what it's going to cost to launch on a Falcon 9, about 40 to 50 million, or a Falcon Heavy, about 90 million. And that's just remarkable. So it's really revolutionizing how things are going to go.
Right. If you're just joining us, our guest is Rod Pyle. He's written a book, Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration. And I just wanted to ask you briefly to follow up on SpaceX. In terms of funding going forward, I mean, Elon Musk has deep pockets, but not nearly deep enough to continue. Do you think that he will get the backing, the financial backing, to keep going at the pace that he wants to?
Yeah, because NASA needs him and Jeff Bezos very badly. As you probably saw, Jim Bridenstine, the administrator, released a statement the other day indicating that they're going to slow down, at least if the White House budget goes through for NASA, they're going to slow down work on the very expensive and apparently very hard to do upper stage for the Space Launch System, NASA's new mega rocket, and shift a bunch of their payloads over to commercial flights, which means SpaceX and ultimately Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' company. So you're already seeing more money being committed to the private sector. Some of that will also go to United Launch Alliance, Northrop Grumman, and a handful of others because they do it very well also. But I think this bodes well for SpaceX because SLS is behind schedule and it's beginning to lose support on the Hill. And, you know, it's just cheaper. And by NASA's own studies, it can be anywhere from a half to a tenth of the cost to do it with a company like SpaceX specifically. It's just cheaper to go that way. So I think he's in very good shape.
Rod, tell us about Gary Flandreau, his 1966 paper, and also what is the Grand Tour?
So the Grand Tour was a design that Flandreau came up with. He was an engineer at JPL back at that time. And this was a mission that would allow you to kind of do this one big sweep of the outer planet, because they are all coming into a position where if you used orbital assist, which is something that Flandreau kind of pioneered, meaning you would launch your rocket, sling past one planet, and as you looked at it, your trajectory is being bent, but you're also picking up energy and speed, and that sends you to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. And he calculated a method by which you could visit all of them. I think except for Pluto was not in position at that time. And so this was going to be one of those big flagship missions using a couple of big heavy spacecraft. And it was a great idea. And then it went into the NASA grinder. And remember, this was the mid-1960s, early 1970s, so we were still going through Apollo and trying to finish the lunar landing missions, which is where the vast majority of money was going in the space program, was towards the human spaceflight side. So to make a long story short, which, as you can tell, is difficult for me to do, they decided that they needed to kind of ratchet this down a bit. They built a couple of spacecraft basically along designs of the Mariners, which they had already been sending to Mars and Venus. They said, okay, we'll put nuclear power supplies on these. We'll call them Voyager, and we'll do an alternative version of the Grand Tour, which still ended up accomplishing just about the same thing. So the simple idea was use the dynamics and the physics of planetary orbits to send the spacecraft hurtling through the solar system, not to orbit any of them, but to fly by as many as possible. And the Voyagers did that with such brilliance and elegance that I can barely talk about it even today without getting a little misty-eyed, because that was an incredible program.
Absolutely. It certainly was. And my view of slingshotting was always to redirect and accelerate, as you said. But the Parker Solar Probe used the planet of Mercury to slow down its ascent towards the sun. How do you slow down in a slingshot?
Oh, well, see, now you're talking rocket science. This is why I write books, because I went to UCLA for a year and a half in the astronomy program before I hit differential calculus and realized, oh, this is for smart people. I'm going to have to become a journalist. I don't know as much about that program as I should, because it fell outside the purview of that book. Hopefully there will be a sequel. But, yeah, you're right. They had to do some fancy orbital mechanics work to get it slow down enough. And I think it had to do with the really unusual kind of photosphere skimming altitude that they were doing at the sun and the precise angle that they had to enter the solar atmosphere. But that's about all I know about that one.
Yeah, because the corona is 6,500 degrees, and they don't want to go inside of that. So they kind of do have to skim around the sun a little bit in the sun's atmosphere. I don't know how they do it either, but it's a fascinating program. And how they keep go ahead.
I just got to say, you look at that probe, and, you know, it's got, again, the heroism, the machines that go where people can't. You know, this little machine holding this shield up in front of itself against the sun. Okay, don't cook me. I'm just here to visit. I don't know, there's a little drama in that image to me. You know what I mean? It's like just barely shielding itself enough to get the work done, but it'll get the work done because it's NASA and it's JPL and they almost always succeed.
The shield is exposed to 6,500 degrees and the instrumentation package on the other side of it will be kept at 90 degrees Fahrenheit, which is just amazing to me.
Yeah, it gets hotter than that here in Southern California. And then you've got, you know, on the opposite of the spectrum, you've got the Webb Space Telescope going up in a couple of years, fingers crossed, assuming everything works, sitting on the far side of the moon, spending a lot of time in very deep shadow, where you, because you've got to keep it cold because it's observing in infrared, and it's, you know, you want to minimize your use of cryogenics and so forth. And that, too, is amazing because it, I mean, you've seen the thing, I'm sure. When you see it unfurled, it looks like an Imperial Star Cruiser with this big kind of trapezoidal-shaped, I don't think it's Mylar, it's Kapton, I think, shield. But it's a multi-layer, very thin synthetic shield of something that looks and feels like Mylar that has to unfurl just perfectly, and they have to position it just perfectly, and it's way out there beyond lunar orbit, and, you know, if something goes wrong with that one, it's not the Hubble. We can't go visit and fix it, at least not for a number of years. So that's going to be a real technological marvel if that works out as planned.
Speaking of technological marvels, you we're just about out of time, but so much I didn't realize about the Voyager program. You know, Voyager 1 launched in 1977. It will be retired in 2024. All that time just powered by plutonium. Can you give us a quick little, how you memorialize the Voyager program in the book?
Well, it's just a remarkable accomplishment. And if you spend time around the people that managed it and worked on it, it's so inspiring because they were dealing with, this was real basic nuts and bolts stuff back then. Voyager was the first program to use a certain amount of AI, of autonomy. And talking to them about this first foray into sending an automated intelligence into space is inspiring and fun. And just a very quick thing, if I could add, when they launched Voyager 2, which I launched first, as I recall, they had done everything perfectly and turned the computer on and got it ready to go, except that they forgot to tell the computer about the launch phase. So as the rocket's going up and turning over on its back and banging and slamming around, as rockets will do, the computer's going, holy crap, we're completely out of control. What's going on? And started to freak out. And so the mission manager, John Cassani, looked at his computer specialist and said, what should we do? And he said, do nothing. It'll fix itself. That's how we designed it. And sure enough, a couple of days later, it figured things out and settled down, and the mission went on as planned. And as you know, Voyager 1 has left the solar system. Voyager 2 is crossing that boundary as we speak. Turns out to be a much more convoluted and weird and bizarre place than we thought. It's kind of like brain tissue, all roly and folded and weird. And it's the ultimate expression of mankind moving out into deep space.
Great story. What replaces Voyager?
Well, there's a couple of things. There's, of course, Europa Clipper, which is heading out to Jupiter to reconnoiter one of the moons where we hope we'll find organics and the water plumes coming up out of the ice. That saves us the trouble of having to go below the ice for a while. We can study the water for a bit. There's a number of smaller missions being planned. I think the one that I've heard about is exciting, which is just in the very early stages of consideration, is an interstellar probe, which would have a really, really big rocket engine, would sling around the sun as close to the surface as possible to pick up maximum acceleration, ignite that massive engine, and just burn its way out of the solar system at top speed, and eventually reach another star system, but we're still talking decades here. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the Breakthrough Starshot mission, which is Yuri Milner, the Russian billionaire's plan privately, to send very small microcraft powered by lasers to the nearest star system, Alpha Centauri. How soon that'll happen, if that'll happen, we don't really know.
The book is Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration. Our guest is Rod Pyle. Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me.